I'm not going to get very good.
This isn't working.
All right, good evening. Call to order the study session of the Ashland Planning Commission for January 22nd, 2019. Do we have any important announcements?
Nope.
Any important announcements?
I'm sure we can come up with some shelter. No, we don't have any important announcements.
Okay. Do we have anyone for public forum there?
No, we don't.
Okay. We have only two items on the agenda that both are very important. These are replacement pages.
Those are, yes, that's a handout for the transit triangle.
Okay. Thank you.
That's your homework.
I thought it was something I had to read tonight.
No.
Totally relieved. Thank you. the first is a discussion of potential revisions to the Croman Mill District overlay, which Maria and Brandon will tell us about.
Yeah. So I think we're having a little bit of an issue with the microphones. You'll have to let us know if you can't hear, if they're not working.
That one's turned up. I'll go turn it up some more.
So just a quick introduction. This is an information item to update the Planning Commission on the status of the Croman Mill plan. We went to the council last year and asked them if they wanted us to initiate developing a scope of work and moving forward with the project to potentially look at rezoning some of the Croman Mill district. When the Croman Mill plan was adopted, it recognized that the infrastructure was inadequate and recommended looking into a funding mechanism as the next step for that infrastructure. Last year, staff began discussions with the owner's representative, really looking at was there a way to fund some of that infrastructure development through rezoning, and specifically looking at potentially having some residential portions added to the plan area. Of course, if this project does move forward, staff would be looking at a variety of housing types and relying on housing needs analysis to look at the mix of housing that would be appropriate. And this presentation that we're going to give you tonight is similar to the one that we gave to the City Council last year. The next step in terms of just jumping ahead, February 19th, we're tentatively set to go in front of the council with the draft memorandum of understanding that how we would work with the Croman Corporation team in moving forward. So we wanted to let you know what was being considered, this very initial concept at first. And also, the Dwayne Cross, Mr. and Mrs. Dwayne Cross, and Mike Montero, the representative of Croman Corporation, are in the audience tonight. So that if you have questions about what they're looking at and you know what they're wanting to do, I think they're available to come up and talk to you. So we'll start the presentation. So I'm just going to run through quickly the history of the property, because it has a rich history, and I think people wonder why it's out on the edge of town and kind of open like it is and not used. In 1930, it was established as an airfield by two local residents, and in November 1930, the city actually purchased the 65-acre parcel, looking to make it a municipal airport. That went to the voters, and the votes against it were a few times as much as the votes for it, so it did not become a municipal airport. And then it was a sawmill for 62 years, starting in 1934, and the Croman Corporation purchased the mill site in 1982 and ran that till 1996. And this is a photo. You can see it was a back, compared to if you drive out there today, it was a very active sawmill. With just some buildings, not a lot of buildings, but you can see sawmills are intensive outdoor use that takes a lot of area. And then fast forwarding in 2001, there was an application to this was the property used to be zoned industrial, so there was an application to rezone the property approximately 2/3 to residential and healthcare for assisted living. and leave a third of it in similar to employment zoning. The city council denied it at that time based on a need to look at how much land was needed for job creation in the future. And so they denied the application. And then in 2005, the city received a grant to do an economic opportunity analysis where we look at what's the land supply we need to satisfy the 20-year projection and the 50-year projection of jobs for Ashland in the future. And it recommended retaining the Croman Mill site and then looking at some master plan ideas for the area. So then in 2008, we started the master plan process. And ultimately, that was adopted in 2010 by the city council. As I said, the master plan recommended looking at a financing plan or system for the infrastructure because it was a mill site. There really isn't much except Silco Road, which is a rather small county standard road. And the utilities going in the property, there are some, but the main lines would need to be extended. And so the plan suggested looking at tax increment financing, or what people used to call urban renewal. So in 2010, we did a study of tax increment financing for not only this area, the Croman area kind of bubbled up into the Ashland Street area from the railroad tax, from the railroad overpass to the interchange. So it looked at that whole area, as well as the railroad district. The city council at that time decided not to move forward with tax increment financing. The projected cost, infrastructure cost for the Croman area at that time were $20.4 million, and we figured that the tax increment financing could generate about half of that. We have to keep in mind a couple of things when we did those projections. There were some rather big projects included in that besides the main street going through the property. There was a plan to put a street over the railroad tracks to connect to Washington. That would have a pretty big price tag. The signal at Siskiyou and Tolman was on that list, and since that time, that's been put in place. Those were some. It was a pretty generous estimate, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It was more than just the street that we're focused on now. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brandon. He's going to go through the plan, the Croman Mill District zones, and what's included in that.
I'm sure the commissioners are familiar with the site, but just to give you some general parameters, the property is bounded on the west and the north by the existing, on the west by Hamilton Creek and Tolman Creek Road. To the north and to the east is the railroad tracks. And to the south is Siskiyou Boulevard and Croson Road. As Maria mentioned, the former mill site is shown in this aerial photograph as still largely undeveloped. You do see some development along Mistletoe that is technically within the Croman Mill Master Plan, but isn't zoned in the same manner as much of the district. This is the district boundaries shown on a tax lot map. As far as the transportation network, in addition to being part of the Croman Mill Master Plan, it was included and approved as part of the adopted transportation system plan. What you see is the gridded street system comprised of local commercial streets as well as accessways that establish that block pattern. Most notably is in blue on this is the Central Boulevard, which would be the primary access to and through the property. Additionally, in terms of pedestrian access as part of the development or the Croman Mill Master Plan, there was an extension of the central bike path along the railroad tracks, as well as pedestrian paths to Hamilton Creek, along Hamilton Creek, and also one to the south, which aren't shown on this map, but in order to provide pedestrian connectivity where auto connectivity isn't provided. In terms of zoning, this is the zoning plan that was included in the adopted Croman Mill neighborhood plan, and it shows a mix of uses. As you can see, the office employment use is the purple area, so it makes up a large portion of the former Croman Mill site, as well as the Croman Mill district as a whole. Light industrial is blue, mixed uses, which is commercial downstairs, residential above at a density of about 15 units per acre, shown in yellow. The neighborhood center that you see on the north side of the property, adjacent to Mistletoe and Coleman, is also a mixed-use development area that would allow for neighborhood-serving commercial as well as apartments. And lastly, open space in green is identified, which includes an area to the south around an existing pond, an area adjacent to Hamilton Creek on the west side, and then in the very center of Central Park that would be of benefit to the office employment and the neighborhood as a whole. So in terms of the Croman Mill District update, I've outlined some of the objectives here for you to take a look at. I would like to say that in working with the owner of the property, Croman Corporation, and Mike Montero, as Maria mentioned, is here, has been in consultation with the city in terms of, answering the question, why has the property not gone forward with development since the neighborhood plan was adopted? And essentially, the opportunities that existed for larger scale employers didn't pan out following the adoption of the plan, in part because of the lack of an existing infrastructure. The streets, sewer, water was a major factor in why such development proposals didn't go forward, looking at opportunity costs of where they could develop or those improvements were in place. So that really started the conversation in terms of, how is it that that Central Boulevard could be installed in order to develop the infrastructure to allow the commercial development to come forward and those areas be ready for development. I should state that in addition to the lack of infrastructure, there is a considerable amount of reclamation activity that's going on the site. That there's old lumber decks that were buried, a row of lumber and gravel, then lumber, then gravel, then lumber. And so the Croman Corporation has been working since I think 2013 to excavate and remove that material. And we had initial discussions about a year ago that would likely be concluded in January 2020. And so that was in part based on how much material could they reclaim and sell. Interestingly, a lot of the lumber that is used was broken down to a significant degree, was added to imported soil and sold as organic soil for people that were developing new farms in recent years. You can envision what the farms those were. But anyway, that work is still ongoing. But part of the discussion had to do with, as those trucks are leaving the site, that in order to provide a connection to Siskiyou Boulevard, either temporary or a full-scale street improvement at that southern end where it connects to Siskiyou Boulevard. And the question was raised, temporary road access to remove trucks could be processed, but what would it take in order to get the full road improvement at this time, which again, to prompt the future development of the property. Part of that would also include an annexation of that southern portion of the property, which I've highlighted here. So as a response to that question in terms of what would it take to get the full road improvement in, we are discussing, what measure of residential development, which is readily achievable, could be done in order to generate the revenue necessary for that development. I should note that there are additional areas outside of the Croman Corporation that, as part of a scope of work to examine the potential modifications to this plan, that we would be looking at, essentially west of Mistletoe, the trailer parks out to the south of the property, and we'd want to evaluate whether those are opportune for changes as well. So that is, again, the area that the Croman Mill Corporation has within its control and has identified areas of potential zone changes in there that would allow for residential development. And these are the two areas that I was referring to that we would probably expand the scope, as opposed to having residential between mixed use and the creek, really for consolidating uses to be less impacting on one another. The change of zoning to allow for more housing, as I mentioned, would be intended to create a revenue stream to enable the construction of the full extension of Central Boulevard, which would include the water, sewer, storm, electric, and capacity for future development. One thing to note in terms of this road extension, is that this was considered phase one in the Cromlin Mill master plan. The improvements to Mistletoe Road to the north were considered phase two and would likely be triggered at a point that the ODOT yard and the neighborhood commercial center to the north would be done. However, as any development proposal came forward, especially something of the scale that's currently being considered, a transportation impact analysis would likely be necessitated in order to show what measure of street improvements outside of the site would be required as well. So what was provided by Mr. Montero was really a rough conceptual plan for the housing types. And this was in part in response to city suggestions for needed housing. So essentially at the southern side, with any annexation or zone change, affordable housing is required. So they were identifying this as one potential site for affordable housing that would be adjacent to the pond and the open space on the south end. They've also identified an area for cottage housing. And subsequent to the initiation of these discussions, the cottage housing ordinance has been approved and is now in place. So would be another type of housing to be developed. That's a remnant of the cottage housing. They also identified small single-family lots on the property. So the Cromlin plan amendments would change the underlying zoning designations to allow for the development types that are ultimately determined to be appropriate. Maria mentioned the housing needs analysis being one source of information that we would look to in terms of what types of housing. When we presented this to council, there was also a question in terms of the location of housing as to whether there should be a variety of housing types adjacent to the commercial or the employment or industrial in order to minimize conflicts between those uses, and that's something that we would look at as well. And lastly, they identified this northern portion of their property as another option for affordable rental housing. So the really just to conclude, Maria indicated that memorandum of understanding is going to be going to council. As I indicated, we've not formalized the area, the housing types, the mix of commercial, industrial, or housing that would be located on the area identified here as the Cromlin Mill or the area of potential revision. Also, as part of the scope of work, we would be looking at cost feasibility. It's the amount of housing that is put forth. What is the amount of housing that is put forth that would be necessary to generate the revenue to do the infrastructure improvements? Also, issues like environmental issues, the former mill site got a determination that no further action was needed, but that was based on the use of the property as industrial and office employment. So with the residential use, there may be some environmental issues. It's the follow-up for environmental would not necessarily be done until the reclamation activities had cleared what materials from the site that they were going to clear and then do test sites there for residential development. And as Maria mentioned, the development of that memorandum of understanding would help identify the roles that the city and the property owner would undertake. Essentially, there's the modification to the Cromlin Mill plan that would be a legislative change. But as part of that, any of the quasi-judicial specific development reviews, as you know, would also could be concurrent with that or would have work that needed to be done by the property owner and applicant in order to move that through the planning application process. So that was the conclusion of the presentation component. Let me just pull up the slide of the property as well. So if you have any questions of staff, I'm happy to answer them.
Do we have any questions for Brandon or Maria?
I have questions.
Managing. Melanie?
So, I think Michael and I were the only two planning commissioners that were here during the whole discussion of the original Cromlin Mill plan, and I remember it very well. I'm not sure how well Michael remembers it.
No, I remember it.
I bet he remembers it pretty well, too. I have opinions about it.
This is legislation. It's okay to have opinions.
It's okay to have opinions, which I'm not necessarily going to air here, but I want to bring up a couple of things and just check on them with you. So my recollection is one of the major problems with the plan was that the northern part of the road went through a whole bunch of other people's private property as designed, who were not interested in providing their land for this purpose.
It was mostly the ODOT's maintenance yard.
I remember there being at least half a dozen private landowners who came in and told us all about it.
So you can see here some areas in white. Those property owners were not rezoned as part of the Croman Mill Master Plan, wanting to maintain their existing E1 zoning. Mistletoe Road does go through right away. This north section of Mistletoe is through easement to the city from the railroad district, so the city does have the right to use and improve that section of property. Part of what I think you're recalling, and I'm sorry, my mouse isn't showing, I'll use a pen. There is this future phase, laser pointer, that shows a road going right here through ODOT property, and then through, as you mentioned, a couple other private property owners, and this is a developed building. Yeah. Right there. So that is something that would be a future phase of development.
So what you're showing here is one that has it going on the current roadway in the north.
It was both in the adopted plan.
That was phase one.
Yeah.
And then if I remember correctly, it said that we would probably have to look at the intersection of Mistletoe and Tolman and potentially do
right.
a right turn and a left turn lane and extend a sidewalk up one side of Mistletoe so it connected to Tolman in the interim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of this alternative connection, this phase two, is it does move the intersection further to the south from the railroad tracks, which would be a benefit.
I also recall one of the reasons this was problematic is that the existing road is quite narrow and doesn't have room to expand. And we didn't think it would be appropriate for the kind of traffic that was expected during the first phase.
Well, we ended up doing another transportation impact analysis on this specific concept of using Mistletoe. And so when I mentioned the putting in the right left turn lane at the intersection, that was looking at all of that and found it sufficient to accommodate the traffic.
The traffic for the whole development?
For the, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was looking at a full build out
yeah.
of the proposed zoning. So we would have to, in switching from office employment and industrial and mixed use to a residential, there would have to be a comparison between the traffic generation under this full build-out under the existing plan versus a full build-out of any potential revision in order to demonstrate that traffic volumes are equal to or lesser or alternative improvements that might be needed if the traffic were to be increased by housing taking over.
I also recall that there was considerable question about the grade change in the southern part of that main mm-hmm. roadway. Has that been, it seemed unresolved at the time that we passed it?
Well, there is a bank right here, mm-hmm. and so this road was moved to the north to avoid that. There's also a grade change, as you mentioned, from Siskiyou up to here. With the full road installation, it does seem that there is quite a bit of longitudinal, a lot of distance that could be used to accommodate a modification of grade. Let me go to another map that has topos on it. I think the property owners, this is what you're talking about right here, this bank mm-hmm. that is developed, so that would have to be cut and would be a significant improvement as part of the improvement of that central boulevard.
Okay. So, I understand what I just saw correctly. They're looking to change about 50% of the property to residential?
I think I calculated it was about 40% of their property, mm-hmm. Not of the full Croman plan area. So about, I think it was 30 plus acres. But again, this is...
But the original plan, most of the property that was not owned by them was already in the existing plan going to be residential, I believe. Is that on the western edge, most of it?
It was. There's a little part along Hamilton Creek on that northern part that's in the mixed-use zone. Mm-hmm. And that was part of that map that Brandon showed that look, as we think if this moves forward, it makes sense to look at that too, but it's not in their ownership.
So can you explain how the residential property provides funds for the infrastructure?
That would be the proceeds from the sale of the property as well as the profit from development of residential housing. Property owner could probably speak better than that.
By which you're saying the city is not being asked to fund it.
Correct. So the I should say that the opportunity to develop residential housing would provide a value to the property owner that would be sufficient to cover the cost of the city road installation at Central Boulevard, as well as all the local streets that would be provided for that development as well. So I think that was really an issue that in waiting for a large-scale employment provider to come in and build the road has not been successful, but there is a demand for residential housing that would then generate revenue for the road installation. From the city perspective, we're also looking at it not just to get that road in, which would facilitate commercial development, but also to address needed housing types, which is why as part of the scope of work, we'd be reevaluating what housing types are needed. But it really is market rate housing that would provide the return to allow for that road installation to go in.
So that would mean that the city would do the road and they would be reimbursed when the developments went in?
No.
The road wouldn't move until the development started?
Correct. The developer would be required to do the road improvements as part of their subdivision.
So they would only put in the portion of the road that they were doing, or they would have to put the whole road in?
They've indicated that through a rezone for the full development of residential, as they've indicated that that would generate the necessary funds to put in the entire road on their property.
Right.
So that phase one section of the Central Boulevard.
So that basically moves from Siskiyou up about two-thirds of the way.
Yeah, up to the intersection of Mistletoe and their property, where if you're familiar with the property, there used to be a gatehouse at that location.
So as part of the scope, we would look at some kind of phasing plan. That would be laid out in terms of the street construction.
I'm sorry, Lily, we cut you off 10% before you went through your questions.
It's okay. Not really. So how will this affect our buildable lands inventory for the other uses, for the like industrial?
That's my question. Look back from LCDC.
That's something we'll have to look at. I mean, again, we're taking this to the council. We're looking at a couple years now, mapping out our long-range projects. We're just asking council, do you want us to work in partnership with the property owners to look at a rezone? It'll still have to go through the whole process. We're not deciding yet, you know, that it for sure is going to meet all the parameters. It's simply getting direction from the council to move forward at looking at that. So we probably will have to look at our buildable land inventory as part of that.
Yeah, as part of the economic opportunities analysis as well. How much commercial land do we need? You know, it's assumed at this point that when the last economic opportunities analysis was done in 2007 to demonstrate that this property was needed for a 20-year supply, now we're 12 years into that period and it hasn't been developed and there hasn't been a demand for that type of housing, then redoing the economic opportunities analysis or updating it might reveal that we don't need as much commercial land as we anticipated at that point in time.
I thought this said you began work a year ago on the scope of work.
We went to council on March of 2018, so about a year ago, and at that point it was indicated to council that in order for us to complete the transit triangle and the wildfire, that we would be delaying implementation of this project until those were completed, which now they are.
Back to that question.
Okay, so I have one question. Do you remember, well, let me just phrase where I'm coming from with this. The idea of the Croman Plan and what we were sold in the very first Council Planning Commission meeting that we had was that we were going to build this out as a very super high employment area. The consultants that we used at the time, you know, gave us a bunch of pretty pictures with 100 people in the audience saying, do you want this or do you want like the Hersey Business Park? And of course everybody wanted all the ponds and birds and lawns and that. So,
five-story buildings.
Yeah, okay. And so that kind of gets to the whole thing when we're talking about the transportation going through there. Do you remember, because I can't remember now, what the density was projected, employment density was projected for this area? And, you know, this would be kind of interesting information to have to compare it with what the comparable residential traffic will be. Okay, so then the second thing is that, you know, part of like the reality, I mean, to me it was always based on just a total false reality that we were going to do this because we don't even have the workforce that was sort of projected to fill all of these jobs. And then secondly, because we're putting it into like the ODOT yards, somehow assuming at some point in time they will like move somewhere else and we would have this. So we have this road connection that right now is going through the property. I get the Siskiyou one. If you're cutting into that bank, you'll probably be able to reduce the grade some. That's never bothered me. The thing that bothers me is you've got a whole bunch of mistletoe road before you even hit Tolman Creek that is totally inadequate to do anything with this. And so that's part of what needs, you know, when council is going to look at it, the reality is probably some of the other parts of these projects that probably may not even get developed. So you have to look at, like, this is going to be the main road into this whole thing going on Mistletoe, you know, with also the other businesses on the other side of the street. So that's it for right at this juncture.
Thank you. David, did you have a question?
Okay, in going over the materials, I saw that they looked at the issue of March 5th, 2018, and it talked mainly about the work program, but there were some concepts in there that would be like the housing, the roads, and specific land use things that were listed. But I don't see anything in there, and it was in the staff report too, where they discussed that in the minutes, that all they did was give direction to look at the work program. They never gave any direction as to whether to look at housing, look at this, look at that. At least that's what I can only see in the minutes. And then, but there was the statement in there that staff anticipates providing a scope of work for council review by late spring or early summer. Brenda just explained why they didn't do that. And in the resource requirements, it says that when you're doing the work program that you were going to see then, that it would be good also to look at, as part of that, a memorandum of understanding, or if you couldn't get the memorandum of understanding, do it soon after the work program. Now, what I'm hearing now is, here comes the memorandum of understanding, and I've seen nothing that indicates any kind of work program that's been done yet. This drawing right there was attachment 3 in the March staff report back last year. There's no mention of it. The only mention was attachments 1 and 2, but there's no mention of this, no discussion, nothing. And then all of a sudden it shows up again. And this is the kind of stuff that gets generated after a work program. And having seen a work program yet, And the work program is to outline the process, how much it's going to cost and everything. And then with that direction from that work program, then these kind of things would start surfacing. At least that's my read of all this. So I'm not only seeing the cart before the horse, I'm not even seeing the horse right now.
Hayward? Yeah. You know, I was at that council meeting, and they were very, very vaguely general. It's just been the feeling with council all along, as with the developer, you know, the owners of the property, nothing has moved on. And so they just simply gave the staff, try to figure out some different ways, and that's why this is like coming to us. There was no direction from council that was specific at all.
Except the minutes did say do a work program. The minutes do say that.
Yeah.
You read the minutes. They say do a work program.
Again, knowing their vagueness and what they were saying, work program is another thing.
Well, that's kind of difficult for me when that's all I've got to read. But then the biggie in this thing up here, a big biggie that's part of this work program, is the employment report for Oregon Department of Land Conservation Development. That I'm not sure when that gets done, how it gets done, but you could do an awful lot of work to refine this, to back it up and have enough to take it to hearing. And then you do that report, and they say, but how much information do you have to give them to get direction from them to see how far you can go in directions? It's kind of a chicken and egg thing, and I'm not sure how much you put, how much credence you put into their report or how much work has to go into it, but that seems like a very, very important element to get from them. So, and that's in the work program, too. And you can probably explain, if the work program is done, how that gets done, because I can see doing an awful lot of work, and then they blow it out of the water with that, or vice versa. Maybe you can explain a little bit better how that report works and okay, is it serious enough to
maybe a question to Brandon would be appropriate about how the staff conceives the order of the order of things from here on out.
But they're only a memorandum of understanding and not a work program going before the council on the 19th, correct?
No, it's a memorandum of understanding with the scope of work.
Right. I wish they'd said that, because it doesn't say that. And I wish that if I would, as a commission being asked to comment on something that's going to, that it's available, I would have liked to have seen that scope.
Well, I don't think
and then I would have had the question.
I don't think they're asking for our comment. Right. Yeah, this is just sort of a briefing.
Yeah.
This is
this is council driven. And I think all the things you mentioned, I think, are going to have to happen. During this process, I'm not sure what will happen when. But we definitely are, one of the big deals is going to be making sure that the state agrees that we have sufficient authority. Alan?
So two things. What has anything happened with the railroad crossing that has been contemplated from time to time? You mentioned was in one of the analysis.
No. I mean, I think there's a placeholder in the TSP. And even in the Croman plan, it's contemplated as possibly a pedestrian bicycle crossing only. Every time we talk to ODOT in the past about getting that in a railroad crossing, it's not very encouraging.
Take one way to get one.
Yeah, basically, you got to lose one to get one.
Right.
Yeah. The other question I have is, I know at some points we've talked about having to phase in or a proportional build-out of residential to the employment. Is that part of this mix? Is there a proportional build-out, or is it really just change the zoning and just let it develop kind of natural?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's to be determined through the scope of work and the outcome of that. I do think that the applicant at this point is talking about the development of the residential for the phasing in of the road improvements,
so
that would probably take precedence over a proportionality in commercial development until that road improvement is in.
Then you have a question?
Is the
there any issue with regard to other infrastructure improvements that would be required down the road, and whether and how those would actually be accomplished?
You know, so I know that there's like a 6-inch water main going down Mistletoe. Whether that's adequate for full build-out, I'm not sure. So Public Works, as part of any rezone, would evaluate whether the existing infrastructure to the north and south is adequate, and whether any off-site improvements would be needed.
So utility-wise, I'm thinking, and I didn't look back at what the master plan said, but I had this idea that there were rather expensive improvements that were contemplated as being part of the development of this whole site. And you, I guess you alluded to this, you know, large price tag, some of which has gone away because they were improvements that have been done for other reasons since then. But are there other than the road system itself or the utilities that would sort of go along with any development, you have to address whether there's capacity, and if there isn't, address them. Are there other aspects of the master plan that are going to present obstacles to development?
Well, there was, you know, there's a central park, that green area in the center on the map, and so that was potentially a, you know, whole block of, could be an expensive improvement. Also, you know, parking structure was contemplated. That was really when it was looking at the more intense office uses and trying to, you know, centralize a parking structure. So depending on how the plan mix turns out, that, you know, that might not still be a part of that. I'm looking at the list right now, the extension of the Central Ashland bike path. I mean, that's really, you know, back in 2010 when we looked at it, we projected $680,000, which compared to about 10, or, you know, basically about, I don't know, $10 million for the road and utilities isn't that, you know, proportionally isn't as much. But like I said, the Washington Street extension or the railroad tracks was in there, the Tolman-Siskiyou signalization, and then also the new street connection from Tolman to Washington, which came in front of the Planning Commission, is being done by the city now. That's what's called, we call Independent Way now. So those are... Okay.
Wasn't there some sort of a mass transit stop or something like that? That was...
General vicinity, there was a set aside of land that would allow for either rail or rapid bus transit. Or even, one thing to note is that with the full improvement of the Central Boulevard through here, RVTE would shift from going down Tolman to going down this area. I'm sure there'd be a timing on that once there's development in place that could accommodate the bus line. So there would be bus stops.
That's guaranteed that they wouldn't just shift because there's been new development?
Well, as part of our transportation system plan, it identified that as the future bus route upon development. What I'm getting at in terms of the density of development, the first 15 houses go in, isn't going to be substantive enough to cause the relocation of the bus line that's currently going up and down Tolman and serving more. But once that balance shifts, then RVTV has indicated they would be moving their bus line.
Yeah, you'd have to have density there to make it worth their time.
Right.
So, but how does all of the rest of that get paid for? Does that just take care of itself once you've, like with this residential development, do all the rest of these infrastructure improvements get paid for in the matter of course? Are they required to be paid for? If this is rezoned as suggested, mm-hmm. Does everything get taken care of, or is it just the road that gets taken care of?
Well, at this point, we're talking about the road.
And how does the rest of it get handled, is I guess my question.
You know, I think some of that is identified as developer-driven in the TSP. So, I mean, the city could also, you know, the plan and the district is... They can apply for major amendments, so there is a chance as the area evolves, if it evolves, you know, something, you know, the Central Park area, for instance, might start to look different, or,
It's hard to say.
It has to look pretty early stages here.
Yeah, and in terms of the neighborhood center at the north end of the property where the transit center would be located, that's outside the current or McCormick Mill property area, so they would have no ability to facilitate that. I know RVTD has talked with ODOT about acquisition of a portion of that property in order to facilitate that, but again, those are a future development proposal.
I'm just thinking about incentives. You know, if the city still considers all of those things to be important, I guess my question is sort of how do you build that in? Because you're granting an incentive here to get a road, and is that, I guess that, you know, is that enough? Is that enough of an incentive? If there's this whole other list of things that's supposed to happen, how is that? That was my question.
Well, the transit center was never that much. I mean, I think it just showed maybe a pretty modest shelter. So it's not like it was a...
I don't know what any one of these things is. It's just that I think that has to be looked at. As a, you have to look at the whole package of what you're granting up front to get what, and is it enough, is all right. I'm saying.
Any update on the ODOT property? I just know we've always talked about that. They want something close to the Siskiyous, and then they built something at the Merwin Interchange. I just know we've been talking about it for 15 years.
Yeah.
Nothing new?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a pretty good site for them right now to stage for the mountain pass.
Well, that's what I've heard as long as I can remember. So I'm just like, what's ever going to change that to allow this to happen?
Yeah, just assumptions on my part, market value of the property versus alternatives.
So the feedback that I heard about the original Cromin Mill plan is that all of the fancy ideas that we had and all the requirements that supported them, building a kind of a high-rise, you know, streetscaped parking structure development, you know, development there was just price prohibitive for anybody that would want to do it. And, you know, I guess the question I have is, like, are we moving forward with that as the, like, here's the housing needs and we're still going to do that thing on the remainder? I mean, is that just going to be an assumption or is that going to get re-examined as to what kind of, you know, thing we're requiring there? I mean, here's my opinion, right? I always thought it was a pretty pie-in-the-sky idea, and that land there on the edge of the town was much better suited for things like lumber stores or, you know, something more extensive because of space and for, you know, we have needs within the city that could use more space. None of that stuff could happen there. OSF couldn't build their, you know, costume shop there, you know, within the kind of parameters that we were setting because of the cost prohibitive. And so I'm just wondering, are we going to take another look at that?
I think by opening up the Cromin Mill plans, opportunity for the commission and the public to weigh in on any aspect of the plan. And so one that came up most recently when we were talking about the Transit Triangle is upon approving the Transit Triangle, if this leg of the triangle ends up going through this property, is it appropriate to look at some of the standards that were adopted in that Transit Triangle as applicable along this new boulevard? So in terms of the road improvements, it is a boulevard by our TSP and that has specific standards for the development. So those will be looked at as part of any current rezone project. But as far as land uses and height of buildings and you know, limitations in terms of outdoor storage, those kind of things could be looked at, but that Maria might know better than I whether there was any kind of direction from council to go that far, or was the primary objective to do infrastructure improvements to then facilitate the development of commercial. So one of the first steps in developing a master plan would be to create a series of objectives, and one of those objectives in terms of if it's looking at existing Cromin Mill zoning for alteration to that, or is it looking at rezoning to accommodate residential? And I can't really answer that because we haven't started down that line and nothing is fixed at this point.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we'll get feedback from council on where they would like us to go or where they would like us to stop.
That's a big assumption. who's driving?
We can always ask. Any other questions of staff, Alan?
Will there be any pedestrian connectivity over to the school now that there's a huge new residential element right there? Is that in there?
I think we had that in the original plan.
Yeah, the original plan shows a pedestrian connection here, mm-hmm. and then north to south along this
right.
to the school. So
that would get built up.
Yeah. yeah. And I think in terms of off-site improvements outside of the Crowman Mill, getting back to Commissioner Thompson's question, as part of a rezone application, if that's a public infrastructure that's necessary for accommodating all modes of traffic, that's something we would have to look at.
Comment, back in 2010, still a chance to buy a house in Ashland, which means you could buy a house, you might be able to work here. That's every 6 months that gets tougher and tougher. So a house for someone to live in to work, can't have a place to work because they can't live. It's, and so, really, it's almost like, this is to get real creative and create really good housing for people that don't have to work. That's where a lot of the housing is going anyway. Because I keep playing with that. Got to have a house to work. Then, but you to work, you got to have the job to make the house. And anyway, that's all I got to say.
Right? All right. Thanks. Thank you very much. Mr. Montero and Mr. Koss have been sitting patiently. You don't have to, but if you do have any comments that you'd like to give us, that'd be great. I know this is supposed to be council-driven by now, so you might want to save your power for them.
Practice. No, not practice. First of all, I listened intently to the comments and observations.
They were vibrating.
Well, I just want to share with you this observation. I'm really, frankly, very heartened by the questions that the Planning Commission's had. They are, frankly, questions that we have struggled with. So I'd like to address a few of them while we have the opportunity this evening. So with regard to Commissioner Thompson's questions, the utilities can't be apart from the road. It's all part of the city system. If we just think about if there's going to be residential, you have to have all the category of facilities. You've got to have sanitary water, you have to have storm drains, and then you've got to have a street. The incentive here is that there is a market, or there appears to be a market, in the city of Ashland for the type of housing that your planning staff approached us with, which is small lots in the cottage developments. I will just take you back about 60 years ago when I was growing up in Hayward, California. And we lived in a neighborhood, and the standard house in our neighborhood was a two-bedroom, one-bath house, about 900 square feet with a single car garage. And nobody felt that was substandard housing. That's what we all lived in. 60 years, we've come full circle. And that needs to be the standard housing. And can't quite see your name. The comment that you made about the reciprocal issue between housing and employment, you couldn't be more spot on. The three major employers that we discussed this project with over the last 15 years raised precisely that question. It's just, are there affordable housing stock in Ashland? There wasn't then, there certainly isn't now. However, these small footprint, back to when I was a kid type houses, can be constructed at a lower price point, and that meets not only the housing needs that the city has, but at the same time, we believe that that provides then the housing availability for to attract major employers. So we think staff might be onto something. the issue with regard to the grade differential at the south end of the property, our civil engineering firm, CEC Engineering, along with the Oregon Department of Transportation, looked at that. It can be constructed. We have, along with the planning department, worked with both Jackson County and with the Oregon Department of Transportation with regard to this conceptual plan and that intersection location on Siskiyou. And so we have verbal, and we think that that would meet our state standards. So there's been a fair amount of work done. In the years that I have worked on this, this is probably the first time that I have been able to see a critical path going forward, not just for the housing, but for all of it. The fact of the matter is, unless and until the infrastructure is there, you know, unless you're going to give the property away, and even then, it's hard to know if you can attract somebody. It's probably going to be the next 10 years you'll be looking at the same thing, other than the cleanup will be done, you know, on schedule in 2020. I verified that this morning with the firm that's cleaning it up. So I think your questions are well placed. I think that your concern about the state, at least it's been my experience, and I don't want to speak on behalf of staff, but as you go through the comprehensive plan amendment process to change and to accommodate this master plan revision, there's ongoing consultation with the Department of Land Conservation and Development staff to avoid precisely what you were concerned about, just putting in tons and tons of work. And it isn't just work, it's resources that the city of Ashland has to spend and that we have to spend. So there's no point in getting too far down the road and having too much investment unless you think that you've got a critical path to meet the state's requirements. So I applaud staff in their approach here. I believe that this does meet really an underserved market in the city of Ashland. I think that it prepares the way for the eventual employment utilization that you're looking for. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Great. Thank you very much. Question?
No, I just wanted to make a comment. I would say that the situation growing up here in Ashland 60, 70 years ago was exactly the same. And, you know, and I'm actually quite heartened to see that, you know, that this is a possibility that you're, like, exploring, you know, rather than the sort of Hayden Home type development that's happening in Medford.
And if I might, I'd like to address a comment that Commissioner Menlin made. I, like you, believe that the plan that was developed by Crandall and Rambula under the TGM grant was very aspirational. Mm-hmm. And I think what history has proved is that your suspicions were correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Melanie and I were the two out of the nine that voted against the plan.
Yeah, I have one question. Okay, go ahead.
I think I already know the answer, but in the transit triangle, places we wanted more density, but because of size of the parcels, how it impacted surrounding uses, thing, some of the density that we wanted to put in there, we couldn't get in there. I think New Normal, there were some things we wanted to do because of the various parcels, and because they're 20, 10, 5, and we run into size of parcel, and some of our creative solutions, we have to pare them down based on, here we got 65 acres, varying topography. You could put 5 stories here, 3 stories here. You could really get creative in here. The impacts on surrounding, because you've got such a big property, it's what we always talk about. We say we don't have any big property, that if somehow they work on the transportation throats on Siskiyou and Tolman and get those resolved, would you be interested in looking at some more density if you want to get creative?
Let me just respond. The conceptual plan that Brandon showed you on the overhead, particularly the multifamily and the cottage development, that's not just a pretty picture. That was developed by a land planner that I think some of you may be familiar with, Robert Foster Consulting in Lake Oswego. He's done a fair amount of work here in Ashland.
Okay.
That plan, what you see represented there, actually is in conformity with your existing cottage ordinance. So it wasn't developed to say, this is what we think you want to see. So that density, as far as we know, can be achieved.
Okay, I'm saying if we saw a lot of good things we liked in Portland, but they were for Portland because they couldn't fit here. It just didn't work. Because size, parcel, a whole bunch of things. But here, with 65 acres, maybe some of those things we thought.
He's thinking even more density, but that requires more, maybe more road and maybe more.
Yeah, well, I did bring up
the transportation. There's always trade-offs for that. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you for the opportunity.
We really appreciate it. It's an exciting project, and it is exciting to have a large parcel in the city. You don't get that much, so it's a great opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great discussion, everyone. Thank you so much. Any final comments, or should we move on to open space?
I think it's a railroad district. Can you stop the rock shuttles down there?
15 acres.
Yeah. 15. Yeah. Okay. Scott, what is the conceptual MOU or whatever for that 19th meeting?
Once it goes to the council packet, we can send you the link to the council packet.
That'd be great. Okay, now this is something we've always had interest in. Is what the hell is open space? Eric is going to tell us. I actually went through the code in 2017 when I first started complaining about this. And Berna Marie is here on this, and she started, you know, patting me on the head and going, we'll get to it, Roger, we'll get to it. Went through the code, and I had every mention of open space in the code, and it's really confused. I mean, we do stuff like, we define yards as open space.
Yards are open space.
I mean, it's like, whoever drafted this ordinance that we're using a plan code or a performa code or something.
Model code.
A model code. Mm-hmm. But whoever did the model code, open space was their favorite word, and they use it for everything. Whatever they could think of what to call something, it's open space. So it's this is an opportunity to clean up that, and maybe we don't get in so much confusion when we get these, there's a typical place, which the staff report points out, where we have a lot of conceptual difficulties when we get a site design that's asking for a open space bonus and for the open space required by the site. And we're going to keep scratching our heads about that and changing our minds. And so. And by the end of rant, thank you. Sorry.
I took my rant now. So you're all aware we've been talking about this for quite a while. You went to this site on Hersey back in 2017 when we were doing tours to look at open space on various sites, and then subsequently we had a study session and talked about it some more later that year, and then didn't make any changes to the code, and questions continue to come up basically every time we have a project involving open space. So staff really felt it would be a good idea to talk about it outside of a land use action and see if we can maybe get to some clarity for staff, for you, and for applicants outside of an individual application. So you have the staff report with you in your packets. I just sort of went through and tried to give you some of the elements of the code that that apply in terms of the definition of open space. As Roger mentioned, open space is defined in the definition section as a common area designated on the final plans of development permanently set aside for common use of residents of the development. It's landscaped or left in a natural state, doesn't include thoroughfares, parking, or improvements other than recreational facilities. I threw in porches here just because I think that's going to be one area we talk about, and really the key element I thought of that definition is that it does speak to the dimensional requirement of not less than 6x8 in the current definition. And then in terms of open space required, performance standards talks about developments with a base density of 10 units or more required to provide a minimum of 5% of the total area in open space. It's not subject to bonus point calculations. And then the area where we really, I think, get into a fair amount of confusion is within this multifamily site review. There's a requirement for recreation area under the open space requirement equal to at least 8% of the lot area dedicated to open space for recreational use. Has to be surfaced with landscaping that allows suitable surface for human use. And then it speaks to decks and patios and similar areas being eligible for open space consideration here. And also talks about play areas. And as you all know, that deck and patio item number three there is probably the area that has caused the most confusion, and a fair amount of what I have here later gets to that, and if we could clear that up, I think we would solve a good part of the issue. I pulled in the cottage housing open space language here. I didn't think we really needed to get into it other than be aware that we do have some more recent language in the code that that you all have thought about more completely, and pulled in requirements in terms of some dimensional requirements and requirements for walkways to provide a border of or fencing or landscaping or berm to provide a border as a visual boundary of the open space. And then the cottage housing requirements also to get into, in addition to kind of common open space, they have a separate private outdoor area requirement for the individual lots. So the distinction between common and open space and private outdoor areas. So I mean, as we're looking at all this, thinking about particularly multifamily developments, you're talking about either 25 or 30% of the site, 35% of the site being required in landscaping on multifamily projects, and within or in addition to, depending on how it works out, you have parking lot landscaping requirements of 7%. You have the multifamily site design review requirement of 8% of the site, and you also have required open space of 5%. And all of those may or may not come into play on each action. So really, for staff, I think it's key to think about open space in terms of how you want to define it, what the purpose and objective of open space is. Should it be required in all cases to be common area? And from staff perspective, I think performance standards, that 5% requirement in performance standards doesn't really seem to be causing any issues, and it's really the 8% for multifamily site review and specifically the deck and patio confusion of common area that really could use some further definition. So in looking at this, staff have looked back in the site design guidelines in 85. This is the diagram that was in the code in 85, and it sort of gets to distinction between public in terms of street and sidewalk, and then the transition into semi-private space in terms of porches, entryways, and front yards, going into private interior space, and then private exterior space in terms of decks and patios. So I think at the time that that deck and patio language went into the code, we did have materials in the code that really defined decks and patios in terms of them being private. And while the code didn't speak to that in terms of saying private decks and patios could be considered for open space, there was this in the site design standards that really spoke to that. But then there was also language in the code in the guidelines that talked about it not only encouraging play areas for children, but that open space should be areas which provide for a variety of outdoor activities, including team sports. So we've come a long way, and we're still confused. So in your staff report or packet, we've included a number of questions to think about, and I'll go through these in terms of, in looking at it, what do you think does or doesn't work with open spaces, having seen projects go through the planning approval process and then be built? Are there particular size, location, or design features that make outdoor space more or less functional? And also thinking about multifamily site design review, there in the illustration, it does talk specifically about private outdoor space and then common open space separately. So we don't have anything currently in the code that talks about the distinction between private outdoor space and common outdoor space. should those be looked at separately and have separate requirements similar to what's done in the cottage housing section? That may be something you want to consider. In terms of the question of whether all open space should be in common ownership, we also think it's important to consider whether open spaces with unique natural features get better protection when they're under common ownership. This is the wetland at Snowberry Brook out on Clay Street. And I think a wetland of that scale certainly is better protected when it's located on a common or public parcel rather than privately owned. Then again, the big issue really gets to be decks, patios, and similar areas, and how those should be considered in meeting the open space requirements, and whether semi-private spaces such as porches are similar areas if they provide a sufficient area to accommodate outdoor recreation use by tenants and somehow relate to common space. And this one on Hersey, I think, was a really good illustration to go to on our site visits back in 2017, because you had great deck space that showed you a deck or patio could be common and provide a very good open space function for the livability of that development. But you also had some small private porches or patios or decks here that may have had a barbecue or chair on them. And do they work as well to serve that function? In looking at porches specifically, I kind of fell back to the Pocket Neighborhoods book by Ross Chapin, an architect that has done a lot with cottage housing, and he talks about porch design in detail in his book. And I think it helps as we start looking at porches to consider a book like this that's really thought seriously about what makes porches work. What he talks about is making sure that a porch is large enough, and he says, well, 5 or 6 foot dimension is sufficient. It really should be maybe 9 to 10 feet by 12 feet to make it a real outdoor room as an extension of the main building's living space. He points out that you shouldn't have a walkway, as we've talked about, cutting through the porch space, and that if you arrange a lane through the middle of the gathering space, you should make sure that the spaces on either side are big enough to accommodate recreational use. And he did say it's important to keep that porch space open, not wall it in, noting that a porch really contributes to the life of a public space around it if it's done right. And he thinks it's important that you define the edge of a porch with a rail. He talks in some detail about the layering between the public and private realm with porches, in terms of making sure that going from common public space to private space, he really talks about 5 layers of perennial plantings, gate, front yard, the porch rail, and then the porch itself as sort of defining that transition. So as we start looking at some of these examples from Ashland and elsewhere, I think it helps to keep those in mind in terms of as you look at these and see what may seem like it works and what doesn't. Some of those design elements that he's considered, I think, play into it. So I think this is on B Street, and you can see, you know, an upper level balcony with some seating, as well as a porch that's not really very well defined down here with seating on it. And how those might work versus a porch on Mary Jane. This is on Siskiyou, and you see the porches are really, or patio areas are really fenced in and not relating very well to the public realm. At Verde Village, this is before the units were occupied, but the patio areas are down below the level of the common area and also fenced in. And then you all at that site visit again saw kind of how on Mountain just past East Main, how the common area there worked, both in terms of the way the porch and patio areas were fenced in and really separated off from the open space.
That landscaping, because we really talked, that landscaping counted.
I think when this happened, that landscaping and that walkway counted as part of the open space, as well as, I believe, the patio areas outside the doors. So really from wall to wall of the building on the opposite side, all of that area at that time was counted toward open space. And I think since then, we've really tried to drill down on that and not have it, although a lot of times it's been a condition on every and a discussion on every application in getting there. And again, you have kind of a variety of porches and how they work and whether you think all of them are the same or not, I think it would be good to think about that. And these are all Ashland examples. And then just to close out the porch and patio issue, this I think is a really good illustration from, again, the Pocket Neighborhoods book in terms of a porch that combines the elements that he talked about and how it relates through those five layers then to the public space, and how that relationship between public and semi-private really works to make that project livable. And then again, as you were getting through the landscape treatment and how that needs to work to support recreation, what are the appropriate landscape treatments? I think everybody here sort of agreed that the open space didn't work for supporting any kind of recreation versus one of the Pocket Neighborhood examples. And then this is an example from Central Point where you have a common green out at Twin Creeks and how that grassy area works. And then I think we've gotten to treating walkways as not part of the open space. And the question is, do we want to start thinking about them in terms of the way the cottage housing stuff does and talking about having them be a border and having it work as a border versus bisecting and really taking away some of the functionality? So I think here you have a clear illustration of how the border could work. And again, versus that where the walkway and the adjacent landscaping really bisected that open space and took away any kind of functionality it had to serve really a recreational purpose. How do you want to look at gardens? I think until we had the site visits in 2017, we really weren't counting garden space at all. And subsequent to that retreat site visits and the meeting following that, I think at your direction, we've been counting now some community garden space as meeting the open recreational space requirement here at Verity Village. The one at East Canyon Mountain also has some community garden space included. And then I think one of the last questions in your list was in terms of what level of detail you want to see on plans. And here's that project at East Main and Mountain that we saw initially had, you know, the open space area here shown with the border walkways. We got the landscaping plan and it had, similar to the one that we looked at the site visit, a walkway bisecting that open space and landscaping that really took away anything as a result of that. We came up with conditions that really got to requiring them to delineate out specifically what the uses of each space were. We have a color-coded plan that delineates all of that. Sort of what level of detail do you want to see on plans where we aren't getting to a condition on every action that details what requirements we want them to meet specifically. And then I just thought I'd leave you with that list of questions to think about as we talk about it.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
Can we go over the 5%? The 5% and the 8% is one that we always get it at about 9:15 when we've talked about 38 other issues, and then we start trying to figure that out at 9:15 when we're reviewing a project. We're all sitting there. So the 5% and 8%, are they separate enough where you can say, in this project you're looking at, it's 8, not 5, and this one, or vice versa, or do they get mixed up? And when they get mixed up, that's...
I think that your response to that is appropriate. It is confusing. Mm-hmm. It's very confusing.
Yeah, Derek is going to explain.
I think they can get mixed up. It depends on whether you have that multifamily site design review component.
Well, how do we unmix it? That would be my next question.
Right. My suggestion is that we think about what we want this open space to accomplish. Because, I mean, if the open space definition applies to everything, and I'm not sure it does, I mean, it's not fully capitalized everywhere, even in the definition. If that applies to everything, then everything has got to be commonly used. Can't be any of these private decks and porches. Why not? It doesn't meet the definition. I don't think the definition is appropriate.
Yeah, again, if you go back to what the definition says.
Set aside for the common use of the residents of the development.
So part
and,
of that...
Like, you know, the deck is not common use. And I think the decks are appropriate and they're great and we want to encourage them. And
But, you know, I think the way to, my idea of how to approach it is, what do we want to accomplish with this 8% open space in site design? What are we trying to accomplish with this 5% open space for the bonus?
And then
let's make the definitions fit what we want to accomplish.
Right, and one of the things you could consider is changing the definition.
Absolutely.
Right.
In fact, I think...
No, I don't want to be wired into we're stuck with the definition as
no,
it is.
The definition,
the definition says this.
They come last.
Right.
They come last. And there are a lot of other places in the code that talks about open space and that aren't even in the context of this that we struggle with that need to be... There needs to be a separate definition for that. That's just, you know, generic, you know, space where there's no structures. It doesn't have a particular purpose for residents in a residential development.
I agree. I think we should rewrite it. And, you know, I think that we did a pretty good job with the cottage housing mm-hmm. of being clear about what we're asking for common space, what we're asking for private space, and all of that. And we can take that, not using the same thing, but take that as a model. And I am thinking that we're going to want to have some of both and to ease the transition for our developers so that, like, not all of their expectations are completely like, oh, now we don't get to have any count any private patios or porches, right? Like, we don't need to do that. We need to, like, rewrite it so that we're meeting our goals for what we think is
I'm not sure that discounting private porches and patios is what we want to do.
Right.
I mean, I had a Troy, at the last discussion we had, Troy made a great point of saying, you know, these patios on the second floor, that really is recreation space for that unit.
Absolutely.
It's not common for everybody. But, you know, so how do we, you don't want to, and I don't want the answer for how to, you know, for how to define it. And both of those two things that we were talking about, those are both talk about recreational space too. They have to encourage recreation in some form.
And I guess throw them in there among other definitions. You know, you have open space, and then you have open recreational space, and then you have open semi-private space. So you get those three categories. And some of the folks that you were mentioning do define those things with different terms. And they don't use open space everywhere, but there are a couple books that I remember in the past that you can go through them and you can get a word that actually fits these things, and they're not all open space.
So I'd like to venture an opinion. Just to start the discussion. I think that every housing situation should have access to going outside and doing something, right? That's, if it's not right, you know, out there, immediate door is at least, like, you know, pretty close by. So that if we have developments where it's not practical, I mean, like in the cottage housing, we knew they were all going to be small and you know, have this design that would potentially allow them all to have private space. Mm-hmm. If we're going two stories and with more density and all that, we're not always going to have that opportunity. And so that we should have the opportunity to replace that with common open space so that everybody has access. So I'm just sort of like taking that as a sort of starting point of what we think is desirable for quality of life.
You know, I kind of wish that we had that thing that you showed on the cottage, what we had done with this packet. Because that was, you know, I had forgotten completely about that. And, you know, I should have been smart enough to go back and read, but I didn't. And, I mean, that really does...
I think it happens to be in this packet.
No, I think I left it out.
I meant in our...
Oh, that's in the replacement.
It happens to be in the replacement.
Right, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, I think that's, you know, what Melanie was saying. You know, it's interesting to me because as I got this, I look at the condo that I live in, built in 1979. There's absolutely, I mean, what you were just saying, there's absolutely no recreational space whatsoever. There's no open space. We've got just the, you know, along East Main, we've got the parking strip. You know, and so it's really kind of, it's interesting how this has evolved.
But you do have private yards in the back.
Yeah, we had 200 square feet patio, yeah. But it isn't like a recreational
with a fence around it.
Yeah, with a fence around it. When they're not going down.
I think that's the amount required for the cottage house.
Yeah, but anyway, it's yeah. But I think that's really, you know, I think we did quite a bit of work on that. And it is an issue that comes up. I mean, it's always kind of weird to me when we are taking private spaces and making that open space. But that, so I think once we get into the definitions.
And maybe there's a trade-off that, you know, you can provide. You have to provide a certain amount of common space, mm-hmm. and the rest of it can be, you know, these sort of semi-private spaces.
So my question is, do we, that sort of gets more into whether people need that in order to buy a unit, you know, whether they are going to have a balcony or a private mm-hmm. patio or a private backyard of some sort, versus this issue of sort of for the development as a whole, providing common areas. So
yeah.
I had sort of understood open space as more the second idea, that mm-hmm. it's more about, you know, common facilities. And then I guess my question is, how far do we want to go to really regulate how they build those units in terms of whether they have balconies, porches, and backyards? Is mm-hmm. that, do we let the market take care of that? You know, people going to build monolithic structures without balconies, porches, or backyards, and if they did, would they sell?
Yes.
Would they be cheaper?
Period, yes.
Would they be cheaper? In which case,
no. They wouldn't be any cheaper.
One thing, if you regulate by, like we did in the Transit Triangle, if you regulate by FAR, since the decks don't count against your floor area ratio, there's a big incentive to provide decks, because you get a bigger unit, it doesn't count against your
development.
So there's trade-offs everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I liked, you know, when we saw the complex down on Hersey Street, you know, with the big deck.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you know, that's sort of like an obvious, like, oh, okay, that is definitely a, what do we call it, recreational space, you know, whatever we want to call that, because it does differentiate from your private deck that's up on the second floor looking down on things.
Yeah, it's a different space.
Yeah. But I thought that was
more private.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if when this was drafted, you know, the notion of going to 8% for the multifamily instead of 5% under performance standards, but allowing one to consider private decks and patios, whether there was some sort of trade-off there that you increase the requirement but you open up what can be counted.
Well, they weren't developed at the same time. And the 5% was from performance standards option subdivision, which started out in single-family zones. So that definition of open space is from the old performance standards options chapter that was based mostly on mm-hmm. single family development and single family zones, where people in most cases have private yard areas. So you wanted them to do that 5% only in common area. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that really was just a common area.
Yeah.
Because the context already included
Right.
This is one of these things you get when because this code has been revised. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But then you go into the multifamily, and you don't necessarily you don't have the single family zoning. So there, you have to have requirements that would make them go further than just the 5%. Right. That was what I was getting as they bumped it up to 8%. Well, but all of a sudden, you can count decks.
Well, you can also have more dense development and more lot coverage in the multifamily zones. So I think all of that contributes to requiring, you know, higher open space.
Because there'll be more people using it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is an open space. It can be decks and patios. You know, I mean, it says these private areas, so you could get your entire 8% through private decks and patios.
Unless you believe the definition of open space applies, and that says it's
well, but this says specifically decks, patios, and similar areas are eligible for open space. So it doesn't say that
the definition of open space is common.
Yeah, but this is the specific overcoming the...
No, it's got open space in there. It says that's eligible for open space.
I mean, one could interpret it as meaning that common patios and porches,
Commissioner Pierce is saying, but if you kind of separate the context of how the two codes developed, the common language came from the single family subdivisions and single family zones. So, and the reason that used to be in that chapter, and then when the code was redone in 2015, we combined all the definitions and overlooked that used to only apply to the subdivisions. So I think that's added to the confusion.
Don't we have just a nomenclature problem? Mm-hmm. I mean, open space is really the landscaping and open area, quality of life, and this other thing that we're battling with is really just recreational. It's no use versus use. We just need to name them the right thing.
We need to figure out what we want to do and then name them the right thing. We also have goofy things in the code, like in the parking, we have a parking category for boat and trailer sales, retail nurseries, and other open space uses.
Boat sales are
open space? You know, I mean, there's just all this goofy stuff in there that we need to fix.
I do think the issue of in multifamily zones, how that recreational space is divided between common areas and private areas is probably an issue that needs to be discussed. Now, I think the way it's been applied is that you can do a combo, or you can do just common, or you can just do private decks and patios. And I'm not sure that flexibility has not worked in the past, in my experience. I think it adapts well to a lot of different housing types, but the Planning Commission might disagree because we get a wide range of things in multifamily zones. You can get, multi-story apartment developments, or you can get townhome developments that are ownership housing. So those are the cases in the past where you oftentimes only had private yards and decks when you had townhomes, in relatively small lots. So I think it's personally a hard thing to be real prescriptive about. I think we could do a better job with the standards and how you develop open recreational space in multifamily zones. But I think if you get too prescriptive about it, first of all, I think the cottage housing standards are great, but I'm not sure they necessarily translate to higher density development, as Commissioner Midland was getting at. So I think to be really prescriptive about that, you're going to sort of possibly not anticipate a lot of scenarios or market trends.
Can I ask Calvin, if we lump these two things into recreational space and open space, you have a 5% and 8%. Mm-hmm. I've been confused on a couple applications. Do they overlap and double count?
We do sometimes. Right. When you do a subdivision in multifamily zones where you're creating ownership lots, right, then they overlap. And we need to fix that. But my recommendation is when somebody does the 5% for the subdivisions in single family zones, so R1, WR, RR, I believe that's worked relatively well. And again, because you're talking about larger spaces, and oftentimes in those areas, that open space is actually used to preserve natural features, which is allowed in that chapter.
I think the definition works in that case.
Right. So I think it's really
this multifamily recreational stuff where people have to meet both a performance review standard and then this recreational area standard. And I'm not sure how that grassy patch on the site plan counts once or twice. I think it's confusing for me.
Yeah, I think the way it's been applied in the past is we just go up to the 8% and we forget about the 5%.
Yeah, there's also the residential density bonus.
Which is clearly common. That seems clearly common.
The residential density bonus is the only one that doesn't even mention open space. It says that you have to...
Provision of common open space.
Now, you're looking at the performance standard subdivisions.
What are you looking
standard.
At? For what density bonus?
18.50F residential density bonus. I don't think you, I'm not sure you signed it though.
This is
I think I've got it.
So the density bonus in performance standards is clearly common open space, but
outdoor recreational
space. It says the maximum bonus for provision of outdoor recreation space. And it doesn't say the only mention of open space is that it says it's not the purpose is not to permit density bonuses for incidental open space. But that's the only time it mentions open space in there. It just says recreation.
So it's a bonus for outdoor, well that's even clearer, really. It doesn't
It's unclear whether the private areas are recreation space or not. Mm-hmm. The decks are recreation space or not. That's what we hung our hat on the last thing we did.
Yeah.
They counted some of the private areas. We said, yeah, well, those are okay under this, but they're not okay under the site plan mm-hmm. open space because that talks about common areas. Uh-huh.
And that makes sense to me.
And I don't see, I'm not sure why this needs to be different from the site plan open space. It's sort of the same recreation space idea.
I don't know. I mean, that's, and that gets back to your question, what are we trying to achieve? Do they always do the same thing, or are they different things? You guys have seen a zillion applications. Are they always going to be the same thing, or are they achieving two different policies?
Well, I think in my experience in the single-family zones, they tend to more often protect natural features like wetlands and creeks. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that the places in town that are zoned R2 and R3 multifamily zones don't so much have those natural features because it kind of tends to be, mm-hmm. you know, out and up more.
Like the Helen Bath property that was in.
That was single-family. That was R5, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a grove of trees there that was
yeah,
and open space.
Yeah, sort of the wetland area that we yeah. protected as open space.
Right. So, I mean, that's another thing is kind of passive recreational area versus, I mean, I think a lot of people would consider something like a wetland or a creek, and in most planning references that you look at, they will consider that a recreational area, waterways. It's not necessarily something you can, like our definition in the multifamily zone talks about being able to walk and, you know, use it, mm-hmm. but in reality, the way we've applied it is, you know, like a wetland mm-hmm. with a viewing area can be considered, you know, part of your...
See, it's open space, but you stumbled going with...
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to use recreational space the way you were, but we call it...
Because if we say the walkway is not recreational, but in those instances, it's the walkway that is recreational because you can
yeah,
walk through
right.
it.
Yeah, yeah. The it thoroughfare is. Part. Mm-hmm. Bill and I were talking about
totally
this afternoon. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I go down the wetlands. It's recreational.
But the walkway around it is recreational.
Right.
But you can't do anything with walk.
But again,
in our society, that's recreational.
Skip a stone. You can skip a stone.
Not the wetland.
You can't.
Yes. Then it's recreational.
Most planning, other planning things I've looked at do count water as a recreational area. Just for the record.
Whether you can use it
yeah.
or not. Sounds like we're talking in great circles.
Okay. So do we have a suggestion for a work plan?
I'm sitting here after doing about probably at least 500 projects in Monterey. We didn't go through this every time.
Hmm.
And kind of just a little bit of what Lynn was saying is you've got a big number, and if you wanted to put some of it in decks and this kind of stuff, you did that. You made that choice. Or you could do it all in common. And then I want to say also, though, that there was in the condo ordinance, you were required to do some private open space, and then there was amount there. But what I can't tell you exactly what they did, but I think maybe what might help us is to look at and Monterey might be a good example. Go to something like either you were down in that area, Los Gatos, Sunnyvale, some of those that develop a lot of stuff like we've done, and areas that we can think they're kind of like us. Look at 5 or 6 or 7 of those and see how, and they might just. He's tangled up as we are, but I just don't remember going through this all the time. It was pretty...
Lately,
and yet they got... I'm pretty certain that it was a difference between apartments and condos. That it was definitely a difference. That for a condo, you had to provide more open space. If it looked like an apartment, but it was a condo or an apartment, you had to provide... There was a difference there. And then... but it would seem to maybe just take a step back and look at some... Look and see.
Look at how other folks do it. I mean, some codes I know treat for residential development, at least residential development above a certain number of units, they have a residential amenity area or apartment. They call it an amenity area. And it's usually, I mean, I'm thinking San Francisco and Seattle, which are two cities I know pretty well. And those all turn into private interior, gathering rooms, roof decks, things like that. But it's all urban development. It's not, none of it's great.
Okay, it's like a problem. The city's trying to make
it great. Yeah.
Well, so it seems like there's three important categories here. One is performance standards. And that was the area you were saying that you feel there's less of a problem, really. Practice.
Especially in primarily where it's been applied, which is the single family.
Because it's mainly happening in the R1 or
the single family.
So that would be one place is the current 5% notion being it is common area. It's the definition of open space in the code applies to that situation. And
perhaps
some
additional detail about not counting walkways or splitting it. I don't know.
But that's what...
Is that part of it?
It's a site design issue, though.
Well, I mean, have we been requiring that in our single family ones? No, that's just with the multifamily that we said they can't do that.
Count the walkways? Is that what you mean?
Things like the walkway with a little bit of landscaping on either side.
In the performance standards.
Oh, yeah. I just don't see that as much because it's usually bigger spaces, like I said, around a wetland or a grove of trees. So oftentimes there's a link, to that, a path from the subdivision to that area. And that's kind of open space. I don't think that's been a problem.
Okay. But that's one category. And then the next category is the multifamily sort of generic thing, which is where we have this 8%, and we've been flexible there, of allowing it to be private open space or public open space. The developer kind of get, and we need to clarify that there isn't 5% plus 8%. It's just you gross up to the higher value there. And then are we okay with continuing to retain flexibility, where the definition can be broader in that context? And then the third major category is these density bonuses.
Bonuses are the ones where we've really been the most.
Yeah.
We've been the most flexible, but I think the standards and the multifamily and site design standards are a little tighter.
Well, the multifamily site design is where we get into this decks and patios are eligible for open space, and it's been applied to privately owned areas.
Sometimes.
Not commonly. So it
deviates. But I stick my oar in and say open space means
it deviates from the definition.
There's a blank definition of open space.
Yeah. We have not applied the definition strictly. We view this as an exception or an expansion of the
definition. We just have to call it something else. We just recreational space and we don't get hung up on the definition. Then we just decide our private patio is okay recreational space. Just if the policy is we want a certain amount of recreating area, public or private. Like Maria said, if it's all recreational space, then you get down to that deeper level of, do you want a certain proportion? Could it all be private? Does it all have to be?
Yeah. Well, that's here, recreational is a subset of open space. Open space being the broader category.
I think you call it something totally different.
Well, that's just the way the code's written now.
Right. But if we just called it outdoor recreational space, then it would be named the same thing as the bonus, the density bonus. You wouldn't have the conflicting
And
question.
It's common area. It's not private.
Recreational space could be a mix.
Or could be private.
Or it could be a mix.
Because it's not open space, which is defined as common area. It's this
recreational area.
There's some other cleanup too.
Those would be the three major things, and do we want to do different things in each of those categories, or, you know, then try to come up with...
The big question is how much of it do you require as common, and how much do you let them substitute private? Do you have the answer? And here's the answer, right?
Well, not necessarily numbers, but... I mean, I do think that we should specify some as common space. And the two issues that I have in my mind, one of them is there's a way in which we're mandating pocket parks. You know, it's sort of like we mandate patio space for a large commercial development, right? They have to have a certain amount of patio space. In a way, that's what we're common space. And in a way, that's what we're talking about for these multifamily developments. We want them to have a pocket park, right? A space that can be used. That's one point. And the other point is what I was talking about before, is if some of the units have the opportunity to have private open space and some of them don't, I want to make sure that the ones that don't have some place to go outside and on the development. And so I'm sure there's a way to write that, you know, explains that they can trade off.
And you might make the trade-off, you know, that you get less credit for the private space than for the public space, and have a certain percentage that's got to be public space.
I don't say I don't totally agree with you on that there has to be open space. I mean, you have so many places in the world, and you've got full 100% development, but you've got great parks and great, you know, community space. You know, you go to some places and they've got their little pocket parks and it's just covered in weeds and nobody takes care of it and it's horrid.
Yeah.
And you just end up with a scattering of those. So if they're maintained, great. If they're not, we might have been better off having another city park somewhere.
So it sounds like there's kind of varying views on sort of a equity issue, I think is a fair summary of it. Equity to...
Yeah, I think that's a good
open space with or recreational space within the development.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm sorry, hearing both sides.
At least some of it's got to be available to all the residents, I think.
I thought we were looking at two types of recreation space, and that's the private recreation space, private and semi-private recreation space, mm-hmm. and public open space, which is more like the open space that we now have the definition for, that everything is open space. But if you had a recreation space that was private and semi-private, then that would take care of that category and then leave it open space the way it is. That's what I thought Alan was saying.
Yeah.
Leave open space the way it is and just get the next definition out there as recreation space.
Yeah, I think Alan was saying, let's call it all recreation space.
There's some of that in common.
Private, semi-private, and public.
Yeah.
But you already had room in space.
I think
I'm
listening to what everybody's saying.
Close.
I think what we should do is the three points that Commissioner Thompson laid out, look at those and then probably look at some standards, see if we can come up with some better, you know, standards than we have now as far as what should the recreational space look like in multifamily. Mm-hmm. And let you have some options to kind of.
And that's the risk. I mean, there are a lot of goofy things that could be fixed, but those are that's the problem that you run into.
In addition to cleaning up everything, I just assumed that we would do all the terminology cleanup.
But let's not let the good plan become the perfect plan become the enemy of the good plan. If we can fix this multifamily thing, we will have fixed 90% of the problem.
And one other piece, which I would like to have on the table, including community gardens as a major recreational. As we so eloquently heard this young woman present to us twice, I think it's a good idea.
You mean to give a density bonus for that?
You should be enumerated in the list.
If we just put it in the list.
I was
hoping to take good cracks.
That's for the major recreation specifically.
Well, whether we codify our adult playground or we just grit it.
We may be forced to add that.
You had a way to describe it.
I think that if we could get this 5 to 8% mix, if we could get that solved first so that they're not bumping heads against, I bet you if we get that done up front, a lot of the other stuff would start falling into place.
I think we should clarify that because I don't think they're always the same. Just by definition, if we leave these definitional terms where open space can be by definition landscape area, but this open space, this recreational area, by definition can't be landscaped area. It's got to be grass, human play suitable. I don't know if we can just say if you get to 8% recreational area, you met the open space test. I don't know if that always is true.
That's just for the performance standards.
I think of them as kind of two separate categories, which is the open space is in the more single family development and the single family zones, and the recreational area 8% is in multifamily zones.
I agree. I think but we should make, if there's ever a case where they would overlap, that these are two different standards. They don't.
Oh, you're thinking additive.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. That's what I just heard you say. If they're two separate standards, you have to demonstrate and meet the criteria of both separately.
Well, the density bonus and the multifamily site design requirement, those are additive. And you got to satisfy the site design, and then if you give another 5%, if you add another 5%, you get more density.
Yeah, the density is, but the firm standards in the multifamily are not necessarily.
Right. So that's they just don't ever seem, I haven't seen one where they have, where we had both of those.
Yeah, they used to, before the recession, it used to come up. What we would see is townhome developments.
Right.
So in multifamily zones where people would do townhome developments that really are ownership housing on lots, because it would be a performance standard subdivision, but it would be in a multifamily zone.
Okay.
So in that case, I believe in most cases, we apply the 8% with and didn't make them do the 5% also.
That's right.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I think the way it is now, you would have to show compliance with both.
But that is what we did. The 5% can be recreational, but it doesn't have to be. Whereas the 8% has to be recreational. So if you do 8% recreational, it could
be it. Right. But as you said, open space, such recess,
separate requirement or not.
And that's what, that was my question.
Yeah. I think that's a good issue.
If we reduced open space and made it more efficient, would that help affordability?
How can you make open space more efficient?
Just a thought.
When you build it out, that's the problem. You can do away with that, that's the problem.
No putting sidewalks.
But multi-story. Okay. Thank you. I really appreciate that. That was a great presentation. Yeah, thanks everyone for your input.
Oh my.
We went on our way to be better in every way.
At least we know where we're confused.
Yeah, a little bit.
Knowing where you're confused is the first step.
That's the first step of knowledge.
The first step of clarity. If any that you don't know, yes.
You're spoken like a first ball vendor.
Yeah.
But the open space was relatively.